The door-to-door encyclopedia salesman has gone the way of the horse and buggy. That fact has been underscored by the recent news that Encyclopedia Britannica will no longer publish a printed edition of its reference book. There are still 2010 editions available if you have $1,400 and can find a place to store the 32-volume set that weighs in at 129 pounds, or you can access the encyclopedia if you go online. Looks like the internet has been killing off printed reference books. Look at the popularity of Wikipedia and Google, YouTube, and other digital sources. It's our topic for today's Radio Times: encyclopedias, Wikipedia, and how to be a smart consumer of information. We begin our conversation with Julie Bosman, who covers the publishing industry for the New York Times. And Julie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you, and hopefully we can fix that phone there. Seems to me that the Encyclopedia Britannica in its printed form had a pretty good run at 244 years. Would you say that's a pretty good run?
Absolutely. It was the oldest continuously published encyclopedia in existence, but you could really trace the demise of the print edition back to the 80s and 90s when the Microsoft Encarta really started to become popular, CD-ROMs, and a lot of American families started using their personal computers instead of the very beautiful gold embossed print encyclopedias.
So it was really just a matter of time.
It was, and this was something that, you know, had been expected for years. The sales of Encyclopedia Britannica peaked around 1990, this year, or actually the most recent year, in 2010, only 8,000 sets of that edition had been sold. So it had really become a luxury item. It had become something that, you know, a more upscale consumer purchased. It was something that embassies and consulates purchased just to have in their beautiful libraries. It had really changed from when it was something that, you know, a middle-class American family purchased because it said something about the kind of family that they were, that they wanted to be.
Did you grow up with the Encyclopedia Britannica?
I did. I actually have a very vivid memory of a salesman coming to our door in, I guess it would have been the late 80s, to my house in rural Wisconsin. And
wow.
It was a very exciting thing to have a print encyclopedia. At the time, it was really kind of the only way that you could have all of that knowledge in your home at one time.
Well, I think of the paper. I'm a bit older than you, but I remember that the kind of tissuey type paper of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, that may be one thing that has hit a nerve with the end of the print encyclopedia. My article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago generated something like 300 or 400 comments, and it was from a lot of people who, you know, were outraged and upset and wistful about the end of the print encyclopedia. I'm guessing that many of those people hadn't picked up an encyclopedia since they used it to crib their, you know, fifth grade homework assignment, but there's something about it that really kind of revived a lot of nostalgia.
Sure. Well, the encyclopedia is not going to go away. I mean, these encyclopedias are not going to be burned. They will exist somewhere, right?
They will. You know, when I looked around on eBay and Craigslist, there were a lot of people who were trying to unload their encyclopedias even before they knew that they were going away. And I think that a lot of people held on to them because they're beautiful and because they look really nice in your library. But people really don't use them in the way that they used to. You know, it's so much easier just to go into your, you know, pick up your iPhone and look on Google. But there's something very, that simple authority of the encyclopedia is one thing that I think a lot of people will miss. You know, if you wanted to know about one topic, this was the answer. You opened up your Encyclopedia Britannica, and it was written by a professor or a scientist or someone who was an authority on that topic. And now if you want to know about something, you can type it into Google, but then you have to sift through hundreds of millions of results. And I think that's something that people don't like.
Well, and it's really the sort of top-down delivery of information versus the bottom-up delivery of information that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And you know, I think that one huge factor here is, of course, Wikipedia. You know, Wikipedia has been around for 11 years now. When it started, it really didn't have the authority that it does now. You know, study after study has shown that Wikipedia is really comparable in terms of its accuracy to print encyclopedias. And even academics and people who use this kind of information, you know, professionally have come to trust Wikipedia, which is something that not many people predicted when it first started.
And that's something we'll be talking about a little bit later in the show. But what's interesting, even going back to the Britannica, as you said, about 8,000 of the 2010 editions were sold. But Britannica has about 500,000 subscribers online. So it seems to me that people are reading the Britannica. They're just not buying these, you know, sets of the Britannica.
That's right. I mean, this is as much a story about the growth and the evolution of a company. Encyclopedia Britannica, which is based in Chicago, has really moved away from print for a very long time. And one thing that they've done is expand their website. You know, the Encyclopedia Britannica isn't a print item anymore, but they have a website where, you know, 500,000 households pay a $70 annual fee for the online subscription. They can use that, and if they want an alternative to Google, to Wikipedia, and you know, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's one way that the company has gone. Another thing that they've done recently is, you know, they've expanded a lot of their general educational curriculum. Something like 85% of the revenues of Encyclopedia Britannica come from educational curriculum.
Are there other encyclopedia companies that are still making printed editions or printed volumes of their encyclopedias?
There are. There are quite a few, actually. You know, from the librarians and academics I talked to, it seemed that there are really kind of two categories of encyclopedias. One of them is the general interest encyclopedia, like the Britannica, like the old Funk and Wagnalls, which is no longer around. One encyclopedia that is still publishing is the World Book, which was more of an entry-level encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the kind of high authority of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but they, I believe, are the last general interest encyclopedia to still come out with a new edition every year. But then you have another category of encyclopedia, which is the specialized encyclopedia. During the course of researching my article, I wandered up to the fifth floor at the New York Times to go into our library, and you know, we had many encyclopedias still there. There really weren't many Britannicas, but you know, we had a lot of specialized encyclopedias on Judaica, on music, on philosophy, and there may be a place for those encyclopedias.
And were they gathering dust there at the New York Times as they were sitting on those shelves?
You know, there weren't a lot of people fighting over them, I'll say that, but you know, there were a lot of encyclopedias that I could see if you were researching, you know, a very esoteric topic and you didn't want to trust Wikipedia, that would be the place to go.
Do you think dictionaries, you know, printed dictionaries are going to face the same fate as the Britannica? I mean, we don't create many, many new words every year, but we do create new words and sometimes new definitions. Do you see that happening as well?
It seems inevitable. You know, it's very easy to go online and find a dictionary, and not just one dictionary, but many. You know, you can find kind of the free dictionaries. You can find the OED and the, you know, kind of more specialized ones, and there are just so many options online that it seems like you'd have to be a real traditionalist these days to, you know, even just walk over to your shelf and use a print dictionary.
Well, I'm thinking about even atlases. I mean, the world is changing so quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one professor I talked to for my article said that he had a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas, and you know, he was a geography professor, and he still liked to use them when he wanted to look at their beautifully colored maps, their diagrams, you know, that he still found them incredibly useful for something like that, but he didn't use them for their text, and he didn't use them unless he just felt like sitting around and browsing, which had happened less and less frequently.
Indeed, and hard for, I guess, regular people to do that on a regular basis. But is this going to hurt the publishing industry? I mean, not a lot of Britannicas have been sold over the last couple of years, but nonetheless, is this kind of a game changer for the industry?
I think it's one of those things that everyone kind of expected. I don't think that there is really a lot of revenues coming from this kind of book. You know, when you look at the conversion of books from print to e-books, one category that you know has been kind of resistant is reference. I think that a lot of people just have moved directly to the internet for that kind of thing, and you know, it seems like the publishing industry hasn't suffered too greatly for it.
Julie, you mentioned the fact that when you wrote the article, you got a pretty big response. Would you say that was from an older generation? Was there any way to know if that was, you know, people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s that just long for the time of the door-to-door salesman?
I think it really, surprisingly, was across the board. You know, it wasn't people who were just older. It was, you know, I'm in my 30s, and it was a lot of people who were my age and said, you know, oh, I remember when the door-to-door salesman came around. I remember getting the set on the shelf. You know, I was talking to one of my colleagues on the media desk here at the Times, and he said, you know, he remembered growing up in Minnesota that his house was the only house that had a set of Encyclopedia Britannicas, and other kids on the block would always come over and borrow them. So it seems like anyone, you know, 30 years old and older seemed to have some kind of memory of encyclopedias. So I was surprised and kind of heartened by how many people really were kind of moved and sad by this news.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think textbooks will also undergo perhaps what the encyclopedias are undergoing?
It's an interesting question, and it's tough to tell. I mean, you certainly see a lot of the biggest textbook companies shifting a lot of their focus to digital. But there have been quite a few studies that have shown that a lot of students just really don't want to use digital textbooks, that they prefer the print. You know, one thing that we do know about ebooks is that they're very good for a linear reading experience. They're great for novels. They're great for nonfiction, but they're not as great for books where you are reading one chapter, flip around, dog-ear the page, and are kind of going back and forth. So it may just be that the technology isn't there yet.
And final question, Julie, where is that encyclopedia that your family bought from the salesman? Do you know where it is today?
I have to say, I think that it was sold at a garage sale when my parents moved a few years ago.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Julie Bosman. She's a reporter for the New York Times, covers the publishing industry, and as she told us, wrote recently about the fact that the Encyclopedia Britannica will no longer publish its print version. Got a pretty big response, and we're going to carry on this conversation with two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
What happens when Henson puppeteers are unleashed? A new breed of intelligent nonsense that is stuffed and unstrung. A live, outrageous comedy variety show for adults only at the Grand in Wilmington, Thursday, April 12th. A motley group of characters brought to life by the six expert puppeteers from the Jim Henson Company improvise songs and sketches based on audience suggestions. For tickets to Stuffed and Unstrung, 837-GRAND or tickets at thegrand.org. The Grand supports WHYY.
The international memoir, The Good Daughter, is a story of one woman's quest to unravel her mother's past in Iran. What she finds is a life of sacrifice, abuse, and always resilience. We turn the pages of The Good Daughter for the last installment of our series on women who are rewriting their roles in society. Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Please Touch Museum supports WHYY and welcomes Word Girl from PBS on Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. at the museum. It's an opportunity for families to meet this favorite TV character and take pictures together. Please Touch Museum is located just off Interstate 76 with plenty of on-site parking. Word Girl, Thursday, March 29th at 11 a.m. More information online at pleasetouchmuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The publishers of the Encyclopedia Britannica announced earlier this month that after 244 years, they will no longer make available print editions of their reference book. We're talking about encyclopedias, Wikipedia, and how we get our information in the 21st century. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Is Stephen Bell. He's Associate University Librarian for Research and Instructional Services at Temple University. And Stephen Bell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And on the telephone is Jacob Saul. He's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, known for his scholarship on the cultural and intellectual history of early modern Europe. And he won the prestigious MacArthur Fellowship, known as the Genius Award, last year, and was a guest on Radio Times. And Jacob Saul, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Jacob, are you mourning the demise of the printed version of the Encyclopedia Britannica?
I'm not. I mean, one of the things about history is that it sort of never repeats itself, but it does kind of. From the inception of the first encyclopedias, which were called encyclopedias, They were always getting out of date. They were always fighting over new forms. Encyclopedias give a sense of stability and authority, but behind the creation of encyclopedias, there's always a kind of really messy scrum about, you know, who owns the authority and who's going to produce it. And so in the 18th century, there were numerous encyclopedias, and people fought over them, they renewed them, and they worried about them getting out of date. So this is part of a long tradition of struggling with this form of, you know, universal knowledge that's accessible.
Well, Stephen, same question to you. What do you are you shocked, surprised, sad, happy?
No, I think Julie was absolutely correct on the. Here she said it was inevitable. And working in a library, you can see how the students are just gravitating to the digital environment, and that's probably true of many of our scholars as well. They have this huge amount of information available from their desktop, and as she said, that in the case of these general encyclopedias, most people are going to go to their search engine, they're going to type in a topic, and because Wikipedia has great search engine optimization, they typically will come up number one in your results, and most people are not going to go much beyond the first page of content. I did some searches today on just comparing topics to see if Encyclopedia Britannica would ever come up, since they have a digital version, and it never does. Somewhere, perhaps, but I certainly don't think most people are going to take the time to try to find it. They're just going to go right to Wikipedia.
Now, Julie said that she felt, from her perspective, that Wikipedia has gotten a lot better, a lot more reliable. The information is closer to the truth. Do you share her positive feeling about Wikipedia?
I do. And she did cite the Nature study in 2005, in which they asked 42 subject experts to do a blind review of different Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica entries. And what they found was that there was almost no difference. Each of them had a few minor errors. Encyclopedia Britannica refuted the results, but I think commonly held knowledge is that with their emphasis on editorial oversight and trying to eliminate vandalism, they've done a much better job of being an authoritative resource, but only to a certain extent. It can be a great source if you're just trying to get that initial broad view that to find some information. And for example, let's say you were asked to find information about William Still, or to understand the Underground Railroad or the abolition movement. You needed to know who William Still was. Right. If you go to your search engine and type in William Still, first entry, Wikipedia, and they do have a fine article with some good sources and links. The challenge for today's student or researcher is if you wanted to go beyond that, let's say you needed to understand what was William Still's impact on the development of the African-American community in Philadelphia, that Wikipedia article is not going to help you. You need to go much further below the surface. You need to do some digging. You might even need to go to a special research library like Temple University's Bloxon African American Collection and then consult some research experts or scholars who would help you. So for the surface level, yes, Wikipedia is probably going to get the job done for most people.
Jacob, I'm curious, and I'm looking at the quote that you gave the American Historical Association when you won the MacArthur Foundation Award, saying you were going to spend your $500,000 on, quote, wine and old-time learning, talking about hiding out in Paris in old libraries. As someone who does pretty deep research, do you use Wikipedia?
Absolutely, for those same reasons. When you need the dates of somebody and you're writing quickly, you flip Wikipedia on, you get where they were born, you get the dates, you start scrolling down, and you really do have to be careful. And I think the same thing went for the Encyclopedia Britannica. I don't think that serious scholars really, really, used it as a deep source. You couldn't quote it in a scholarly article. The thing is that the problem here is that Wikipedia is really great. I mean, it's 2 in the morning, you're working, you need to know something. It has so many more entries than a physical encyclopedia could have. You get to them quickly. The problem is that this is what the other guest said, is that behind that you need to go to a real reference library and deal with experts. And as the sort of more serious scientific encyclopedias are disappearing, funding for research libraries and for research librarians and for public libraries is sort of disappearing. Right. So this real key element that connects to encyclopedias. In fact, encyclopedias were invented as guides to handling big libraries. You couldn't read everything in it, so you needed a dictionary or encyclopedia to help you handle all this information. What we really need is to keep librarians, public libraries, university libraries, and we need the stacks, too. All of these sort of different tools developed together, and we need them all.
Well, Stephen, has the Internet, Wikipedia, Google, all those search engines, have they changed your job as a librarian?
Yeah, they certainly have. I think the main change is that in a prior time period, it was much simpler to find information. You had many fewer choices because it was a print world. So if you were looking for an encyclopedia, it was typically option A or option B. And now for today's student or layperson, the information environment has become much more complex. In fact, there's a great project called Project Information Literacy out of the University of Washington. And they have been doing lots of research on how students, college students, how their research behavior has changed. And they have surveyed thousands of students. They have done focus groups with students. They have done anthropological research with students. And their number one finding is that research seems to be far more difficult to conduct in the digital age than in previous times. That's because you now have such an abundance of information. It is so much harder to understand what is the good information and what is the bad. So what we spend a lot of our time doing as librarians now is helping to educate our students about how to be wise consumers of information and also being the guides to sort of the information jungle. So we'd spend a lot of our time creating something, for example, we call them sources for courses, and they're online digital research guides, sort of like your old Pathfinder.
Right.
And we actually, instead of expecting students to know which of our 650 databases to use, this is very tailored to their assignment, and so it makes it much easier for them to navigate their way. So that's a lot of what we do now. It's educating, and it's helping people navigate.
Well, Jacob, I know that much is relative, but I know that you focused on 16th century Europe, and did they have their own version of information overload back then?
No, I mean, they went from having, a few thousand books to tens, if not hundreds of thousands of books in actually less than a century, because they went from manuscript to print, and people became terrified of all this new information. But they had something else which was really fascinating. With the Renaissance, they started reading Plato again. And Plato had a theory that if you could understand the world universally, everything, you would become closer to God. So they actually had a philosophy of universal knowledge. The university, for example, is something that comes from this concept. And so many scholars and even artists, I mean, we think of Michelangelo and Da Vinci, I mean, they were thinking about this, getting closer to God through knowledge and creation. Many of these scholars, you know, had this Promethean quest to get closer to God by organizing all this information, and they always ended up kind of failing because right when they got to the point of finishing their project, new information came out and new sources competed with theirs. And this competition and this constant updating existed then, too. I think what's going to be interesting is, you know, we're sort of talking about Wikipedia as the end. What's the beginning? We don't know where we're going to go from here.
Right.
That's what people in Silicon Valley and in universities are thinking about right now.
You want to add to that? And I just have to add to what you just said, Jacob, but only because I live in, I guess, my own version of the world of information doing this program, is that I do feel overwhelmed by information. Mm-hmm. I kind of know where to find things, but nonetheless, getting there can be very distracting, Stephen.
Well, the other thing that we try to do, and I should say that that some of the traditional things that libraries have always done is being the stewards of the great information and the print collections. One of the ways in which we're changing is that we're focusing more on our special collections, our very unique collections, rare books. The Temple University, for example, has the Philadelphia Jewish Archives. So, you know, we see that as part of our important responsibility to preserve all that information for future generations and to potentially put it into a digital format so that the world can now share that information. But we do spend a lot of time, and this is something that is important for students at any level or the layperson who is trying to find their way through all this huge amount of information, is helping people to understand how to better evaluate information. And there are some simple things that people can do.
Go right ahead.
I think there are basically three things. The first one is the hardest one, and I don't expect many people will do this because it takes more time. And people are very focused on getting information as fast as they can, as conveniently as they can, which makes these online sources like Wikipedia so valuable. But it's triangulation. And if you think of yourself as a consumer, if you were going to buy some product, you probably wouldn't just take one source and say, oh, that's the price. Those are the features. You would look at multiple websites. Mm-hmm. You would perhaps ask your relatives if they've purchased that product. If you use Twitter, you'd probably tweet and say, hey, has anybody bought product A? What did you think of it?
Comparison shopping.
Exactly. And you can do the same thing with research. You can make sure that you're consulting multiple sites or a print resource, such as some of the unique print encyclopedias, and I brought some examples of those today. So that's the triangulation, trying to make sure your facts are true in multiple sources. I think most people, except the higher level researchers, are going to do that. The other one that I can share with people is a very simple mnemonic that everybody can remember, and it's called CARDS, C-A-R-D-S.
Go ahead.
And that's credible, accurate, relevant, date, and sources. So the very first thing we typically want to look at is credibility. Who's the author? What are their credentials? And Julie mentioned that, and she said typically with the old-time encyclopedias, you would know who the experts were. Accurate, is the information sloppy? Are there grammatical errors? Are there typographical errors? If that's the case, you probably want to not use that information. Relevancy seems like a no-brainer, but sometimes we're in such a hurry, we might look at the first paragraph of something and decide, wow, this is exactly what I need. You really need to go a little deeper into some content and make sure it really is relevant. The most interesting one is date. You know, how current is something, or at least when was it originally written and when's it been updated? When Project Information Literacy asked students how they evaluate information, the number one thing that students said was, I look at the date, rather than looking at who the author is and what their credentials are. But it's still important. And finally, sources. So you'd want to make sure, you know, where is the author getting their facts from? What sources are they citing? And if you're coming up with some piece of information and there's no footnotes, no references, you probably want to stay away from that as well. So that's the CARDS. And the final one is talk to a librarian. I know most people think we're obsolete and we don't exist anymore, but we are out there. You can text us. You can email us. You can phone us. You can talk to us in person. We are there to help you, and we have the expertise, and we will get you where you need to go.
Jacob, anything you want to add to that? And then I do want to get to some callers.
Yeah, well, this idea of credibility. I mean, you're talking about going to scholars. One of the things that we've noticed in the big graduate schools is that graduate students are tending to also turn to the web and to digital sources. In the old days, you couldn't do this. So to do any research, you had to go to your source base, whether it was in South America, China, or Europe. And you had to sit there often for years and learn these archives and these libraries and dig and find things, basically live in these places, you know, sleep in them. You know, I mean, people do a lot of things in libraries.
Yes, I can imagine.
And the thing is that what you get from that, what you get from this being in libraries for a long time, is an instinct for the libraries, which librarians have, but researchers need this because they have to think their way through their topics. A lot of the experts or future experts aren't spending that kind of time because so many sources are online. Whereas if you go to a library in Europe, for example, the Cambridge University collection, which is one of the best collections in the world, if you spend years in that library, you will end up being able to sniff sources out, understand the call number system. One of the best places to do this kind of research now is actually at the University of Pennsylvania, where they run their library like a lab. And really, if you start smelling something out, they will bring a researcher, certain researchers, into the stacks to see what's around the book that you've first seen, to see if there are any other sources. So there's a real physicality in research that the digital collections are trying to do, but I still think it's very important to mix these together, the digital and the physical.
Well, as you're describing that, Jacob, I'm thinking about what happens when you actually travel to, you know, if you're on vacation and you go to Paris or you go to London. There's no substitute for actually being in a place and smelling it and exploring it and getting lost in it and sort of orienting yourself to what's going on there.
What's the other thing is, remember, there's not just one library. So what might happen is you might spend 3 months in one library, and then someone or some book will lead you to another library, or you might have to get on a train and go somewhere else for something that will never be digitized and no one knows about. And so this physical discovery, which, you know, had a lot to do with basically exploring, the same principle, we still need to do that. However, the thing about the web and the thing about online encyclopedias is you can get through a lot of the static first. Professional researchers can use the web incredibly well to look at books that it would have taken 6 months to wait for, you know, for a trip to look at. Now they can get a look at that book, then they can parachute in and start at a sort of advanced level. So there are advantages and disadvantages. What we're hoping, though, is that funding sources don't say, look, you don't need to travel anymore, it's all digitized. We need the detectives and this kind of Sherlock Holmes spirit to stay in research.
We're almost up on a break here, Stephen. You mentioned the fact that you brought in two encyclopedias. Can you just very briefly give us their titles, and then we take a break, and then we will get to our callers?
Yes, just as Julie said, when she went to the New York Times Library and she found all these really interesting special-purpose encyclopedias, I brought the Encyclopedia of Hip-Hop Literature, which is a fantastic source if you wanted to better understand who are the great authors in this field and some of their writings. I also brought a fun one, and this is, Jacob just sort of kind of mentioned this. You know, it's the serendipity factor of going into a library and getting your hands on the print and making new discoveries that you just can't always do online. This is the Comic Book Encyclopedia. And yes, it would probably get out of date quickly if Marvel develops a new character tomorrow, but it's just so much fun. The illustrations are great. You could just sit with this for hours and have a great time with it, or use it for your research paper.
Well, we are talking about libraries, encyclopedias, Wikipedia information in the information age, and our guests are Stephen Bell, Associate University Librarian for Research and Instructional Services at Temple University, and on the telephone is Jacob Saul. He's a professor of history at Rutgers University in Camden, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents The Ballad of the American Arts, featuring Wynton Marsalis and members of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra on Tuesday, April 3rd in Verizon Hall. This special program will incorporate live performances with a lecture musing on America's premier indigenous art form, jazz. Audiences will be immersed in history, culture, and melody as the Kimmel Center kicks off Jazz Appreciation Month. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or kimmelcenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, conductor Michael Tilson Thomas tells us about his new PBS special celebrating his grandparents, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski, pioneers of the Yiddish theater. The show features music from the Yiddish stage. Also, a former sports agent comes clean on the dirty business of college football. We talk with Joshua Lux about his new memoir. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. So, if the individual mandate falls, is severed from the healthcare law, can the law survive? The Supreme Court takes up that and an expansion of Medicaid. Also, the latest on the drinking water in Dimock, Pennsylvania. What was the impact of fracking? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the demise of printed reference books, the rise of digital reference services, and how to be a wise consumer of information. Our guests are Stephen Bell and Jacob Saul, and we have a full bank of calls here. Let's see what Mike from Westchester has to say. And Mike, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
First-time caller. Love the show.
Thank you.
Sure. I just bought a copy of the last print edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I thought I'd give you a call and tell you why.
Okay. Please do.
Well, one, I like books. You know, when I'm an early adopter of technology, I've, you know, used plenty of e-readers. I find the user interface is kind of fiddly when you want to read something. The iPad's pretty good, actually. But still, there's something great about having, you know, an encyclopedia. I don't have to boot an operating system. I don't have to worry about battery life. You know, the thing's instant on, proven technology. I pick it up and read it. One of the reasons I bought mine was because saving an old friend from the scrap heap. I've got a 1957 edition from my childhood, and I just thought this would be a terrific thing to have since it's the last print edition. So I received it last week in shipping. So I'm really proud to have it.
And where are you storing those 32 volumes, Mike?
Well, right now they're in my office, and at some point I'm going to set up a dictionary stand in my library so that I can always have the thing ready to go. I can't wait to start reading articles from it.
Oh, that's great. Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Jacob, can you do you feel some synergy with Mike as he talks with a great deal of enthusiasm about buying the 2012 Encyclopedia Britannica?
I have a library, too, and it's filled with older, kind of erudite, super nerd encyclopedias for research, the kind of things from the 19th century. There were, you know, 10 authors for each entry, and they have every drop of weird information. And, yeah, I mean, at 2 in the morning, when I'm in my library, that's where I go. And I sit, and those are my sort of secret weapons for research. And there's just such a pleasure. And there's one other thing. You know, in the old days, let's just say in the 50s, they said, hey, kid, you know, you want to go to college, you want to do well, read a dictionary, read an encyclopedia. There's a lot to that, because if you sit and you read the thing, which one finds himself doing, right? You look up something, and then you end up seeing an entry next to it, and you flip the page. Well, you learn an enormous amount, and it turns out that people who sit around and read good encyclopedias, they can learn a lot, and you're not going to sit back on a couch and read Wikipedia in the same way. They are books, and you can read them.
Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Stephen, Mike described himself as a first adopter. So clearly he's in the digital world, but has this great nostalgia and excitement for his Encyclopedia Britannica.
Well, Mike is the exact kind of person that libraries tend to love. He's probably a friend of libraries, and a passionate collector like Mike is very likely at some point to decide that he may no longer be able to keep those encyclopedias. And that type of person would eventually perhaps come to a place like Temple University to say, would you be interested in my collection? And we may very well be interested. That's where some of our greatest finds that go into our treasured rare books collections come from, everyday people who have collected these things and kept them for years and years and years. So we love folks like Mike.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's see what Liz from West Philadelphia has to say. And Liz, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm interested in how to be the sort of the best consumer of the search engine. So, for instance, that I yesterday was talking with somebody who wanted to know how does a wound heal? What actually happens? And so I'm looking things up in Google and trying different words to try to get something that was going to be other than, you know, like something about kids organizations for with doctors or I don't know. It was just like I was trying to figure out how can I be smarter so that the search engine will work for me. Well, it just felt like unless the answer's on the 100th page, which I just don't have time to get to.
Sure. Well, let me toss that first to Stephen, and I know sometimes it's putting in the right words that's and I know that from the Radio Times producers because they are always searching the internet for information. Stephen, you want to weigh in on that, and then Jacob will get you in on as well.
Well, I'm going to mention two things. They may not be the most popular things, but that can be part of the challenge of using a search engine on the internet. You're just going to get so much content. Now, one possibility, if you know how to use the advanced search, if you want to take some time to explore that, you could limit your domain, which is where that information is coming from, to a .edu or a .org or a .gov source. So you'll immediately eliminate any of the commercial sites that might be trying to get you to buy some product to heal your wound. And that's a fairly simple thing to do. If you're looking for something a little more research-oriented, use Google Scholar. That's scholar.google.com. Then there's no commercial information there. You're getting more research-oriented content, information from scholarly journals, for example. I would think for this search, I would try YouTube. I would bet that you could find someone who has made a video about wound healing, and perhaps will even show you a wound healing in different stages. Everybody's pretty familiar, I think, now with Khan Academy and how much learning is taking place on the internet, and that's where people are starting to go for their information. They're going to YouTube so they can watch the videos and learn from the videos rather than trying to find their way through through something like Google or Bing.
Jacob, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, this is along the same lines as Stephen was drawing. One of the things that I do, and it happens to go with medical things or even academic topics, is I do go to top. I will put in the search words, and I will also just put in the name of the university that I think best does this. So, you know, great university hospitals or famous hospitals, or in the case of academic topics or engineering topics or political topics, you can put a great university in, and the universities are starting to put up, departments are actually putting up their own kind of encyclopedic sites. So the experts themselves are saying, look, we don't want to have to, wait for someone to come to us. We're going to put the stuff up on the web ourselves. So you can just go to the experts now. Stanford has put up this wonderful sort of dictionary, I think, of philosophy, of the history of philosophy. And I know that at Princeton in the graduate school, that will even be used as reading. So instead of reading an encyclopedia, you go straight to, you say, you know, Plato, Stanford, and that's it, and it'll come up. So you sort of have to have a sense of that. It's not that hard to do. You can just put in, you know, a wound healing University of Pennsylvania Hospital, and you might end up coming up with something credible and good.
Well, Liz, good luck to you, and thanks for calling into Radio Times to see what Brad from Newark has to say. And Brad, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to remind people of a short story that was published in Library Journal in 1958, called Manuscript Found in the Library. And it talks about a future time when indexes of indexes were out there, the 33rd power, and bibliographies of bibliographies, and everything was computerized, and all of human knowledge had been reduced to the size of a matchbox. And all of a sudden, there's a breakdown in the indexing, and civilization collapses. Nothing is ever able to be found again.
And is that your vision of today?
Sometimes I wonder. But it's a great short story, and it was well ahead of its time.
Well, and it says a lot about the 1950s. Jacob, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Well, I mean, that story probably came from Vannevar Bush's article about the Memex machine, which he started creating in 1945 with the help of the United States government. Oh. And it was a precursor to the web. The web comes from libraries. It comes from cross-referencing systems, and basically it's just a form of cataloging. But Bush saw this as a problem. This is another Bush, not from the Bush presidential family. And Vannevar Bush created this kind of card cataloging reference machine, and so people were on this, and there was an ambition to create a way to handle this knowledge. And he was, in fact, very positive about it. And lo and behold, we do have the web. And I do think people feel overwhelmed, but as we've just discussed, there are really easy ways of getting over that. And every time in history, from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance to now, when people feel that there's information overload, there quickly comes a tool to manage that overload. I think the only thing that we have a hard time sometimes dealing with is the pure speed in change. If new things come on the web or new authorities, that could be an issue. But I think that we do have the tools for this, and some of it's just common sense.
Well, we've been focusing largely on encyclopedias and reference books, but let me toss this first to you, Stephen Bell, and then to you, Jacob Saul, which is, and you both work at universities, the idea of a textbook. And we see, you know, students carrying these gigantic textbooks around, but, you know, the Internet offers information, and in fact, Stephen, you were talking to me before the show about how professors can, in a sense, create their own textbooks using the Internet.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you my firsthand experience is that this is a huge challenge for today's college students,
yeah.
You know, given the large amount of loans that they're taking on to for their college education. And then you add to that average of $1,000 a semester for books, it's a real challenge. And the number one question we typically get at our reference desk the first week or two of classes are, do you have my textbook?
Oh,
every student wants to come to the library to see if they can borrow the textbook so that they don't have to buy it. So we have embarked on a project at Temple University. We call it the Alternate Textbook Project. And what we're trying to do, it's a very much a pilot project, just has a few faculty attend the first time we did it. And we're encouraging them to sort of ditch their traditional textbook and use what I would call learning material, learning content. And it may be articles that are in the library's databases. It could be a video on YouTube. It could be something they've written themselves, a chapter from a book. You know, it's just really pulling together all these disparate resources into something that the students can understand and connect with very easily. And Julie made a great point when she said, when you just have a digital textbook in PDF format that's very linear, no one wants to read that.
No.
You can't interact with it. So I think faculty members, it takes more time. It's much easier to order 200 copies of a print textbook by pushing a button as opposed to spending time compiling all of your own resources and building this digital alternate textbook that is very tailored to the needs of the students. And what some of my faculty have said, you know, the thing we feel bad about is we buy these massive textbooks. We don't even get a third of the way through them in 16 weeks.
Well, Jacob, is that something that it would interest you or does interest you?
Well, first of all, it should be made clear that when the first books called encyclopedias came out, people had to actually subscribe to them so that they could actually afford to produce them. And when those encyclopedias were late, they wanted refunds, and there were always fights about the cost of encyclopedias. People have been grumpy about these costs for hundreds of years. The problem within textbooks is it's not the textbook itself. There really is, if you want a narrative of history that you can sit and focus on and learn it from in a clear way, the textbook is an unbeatable form. The problem is that they constantly reissue them, so students have a hard time buying used ones because the new digital material that goes with them, you know, comes from newer textbooks, so they constantly have to buy new textbooks, and these things cost $120, when honestly they should cost, you know what, $23. So this is a scam that I think is being perpetrated on students. I do worry about this idea of, it's probably just going to happen anyway, but of the backroom textbook. Because one of the things that I do is I buy textbooks by the scholars who I think are not only the most wonderful scholars, but the scholars who write in a way that really engages the students and makes them sort of want to know more and dream more, because history is also a story. And actually, you can write a history of anything, and a good writer and a brilliant researcher mixed together and a good editor can make this an extremely compelling and wonderful experience. So I'd like to keep the textbook, and I'd really like the price to go down to something legitimate.
Well, I'm sure you would get a lot of support for that. Did you want to say something very briefly, Stephen?
Yes. One of the big changes that the Internet has wrought is in higher education and general education is something we call the Open Education Resources Movement. And the whole idea is for the people who create the knowledge, which are the experts, the faculty, the teachers, to take control of their information, instead of giving it over to publishers who will then sell it back to us for very high prices, we can now use the internet to self-publish and share that information with the world in an open environment. And that is probably a conversation for another day.
Let me get one more caller on. Looks like we have John from Shillington. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I'm wondering where the digital serendipity factor comes in. The closest thing I see to Wikipedia is the random article button. But I learned an awful lot just growing up having an Encyclopedia Britannica, where I would be headed to an article, but I would stumble upon three or four things on the way, and I would stop, and I'd look, and I'd learn, and it would excite me. And I'm completely jealous of the guy that just ordered the 2012. I want one,
There's
too.
Still some editions available, apparently. But
hopefully,
John,
I could get one in my price range.
but John, you don't find that on the internet? I mean, there's serendipity on the internet as well.
Oh yeah. There is some. I think that sometimes it just there isn't anything that quite compares to the browsing through the textbook. And absolutely, there is some of that on the internet. It's just it is a very different feel.
Well, I
I have many fond memories of working in libraries as well as using them.
Indeed. Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jacob, we're almost out of time here, but when you got that MacArthur Award, you talked about going to Paris and hanging out. Have you been able to do that?
It's in the future. It's going to happen. But let me just say one thing. Something about focusing and reading. I spent a lot of time on the internet, and so do my students. They find reading books much harder.
Yeah.
Books take more focus. They engage your mind more. It is exercise for the brain. I think what the caller is talking about is the fact that we're moving away from reading. That is a problem, and you just see it with students. They find reading a whole book from beginning to end a great challenge. They don't find going on the internet a challenge. And the books ask more from you. We got to hold on to traditional reading because it's good for your brain.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Jacob Saul, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here as well. And Stephen Bell, thank you for joining us as well.
You're welcome, Marty. It's great being here today.
Nice to have you both there. Or both here, I should say. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Dennis Devine with Jonathan Best, Emily Bryant, the Radio Times intern. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.